surgeon performed the surgery, and Teddy was among the many foreign materials removed from the dog. Upon recovery, the dog began to seize. Respondent's associate had taken over care of the dog. Complainant and her family were advised that the dog needed to be anesthetized to stop the seizures, and it was recommended the dog be transferred to a neurologist for an MRI or CSF. The referral was declined, and humane euthanasia was elected. And the committee concluded that no violations of the Veterinary Practice Act had occurred. It was moved and seconded that this case be dismissed with no violation. The motion was approved with a vote of 3-0.
Thank you. We don't have a respondent. We did get a statement from the respondent, and then no complainant. All right. So, Dr. Nosley, you are the lead on this case.
Okay. In this case, I didn't see anything in the case management that caused me concern. So I think the case management was appropriate. Their decisions and the treatments provided. Communication is the issue here. We have this very unclear, still at this point, history regarding the seizures. Very unclear, very confusing. There were several people involved, I think three people, answering questions about the seizure history, and there was I still don't have a clear understanding of what this dog's seizure history was. During triage, it was said that there were no seizure events previous. That may have been just a failure to understand what seizures were versus what it was doing now. The clustering, almost status. The frequency of the seizure events varied from person to person, and it wasn't just one doctor. This was two doctors. Both the respondent and the surgeon had communications with these complainants regarding the seizure history. And so that made it a little bit difficult for them to ascertain what was going on completely with this dog. The issue of the statements by the respondent that the two problems occurring was unlikely bothered me just a little bit. But I don't think that really rises to the level of a violation. Sometimes we read these and go, I don't think I would have said that. But I don't think it rises to the level of violation. What I'm referring to is that they ask about this foreign metal toxicity versus seizure, and she said, I don't think two things could be happening here. And I think if we look at the ultimate outcome of the case, there probably was two things happening here. I think that the respondent was proceeding based on the information she had and like I said, the progression of the case. The decision to recommend surgery, I think, was also based on sound principles. We had ongoing seizures and other possible neurologic signs, and so her list of possibilities was metal toxicity. And we get the radiology report, and there's metal in there and a circular object, which at first was thought to possibly be a battery. And it's important to note that that circular metal was in the stomach, and that's important. Ultimately, it was removed, and then the dog went into basically status epilepticus and was euthanized at that point. One thing that I didn't hear in all this that I think is important is the round object turned out to be a penny. And pennies in the stomach that zinc toxicity, unless it's a really old penny. And so it likely could have caused problems if it wasn't already somewhere down the road. There was also a ceramic object in there with sharp edges. That one could have been a problem too. So surgery at some point in this dog was very likely to have been necessary. There was an anemia that was non-regenerative, not severe, but I think their decision to remove the objects was appropriate. Could they have waited a little bit and seen? Well, maybe, but what if our problem was metal toxicity? And then we'd be here for another reason. You didn't take it out. And so I think it was hard for the complainants to really understand that, because in their mind, the surgery is a cure. But I don't really think that was the case here or relayed by the respondent. So I don't see a violation in the case, and I'll just go ahead and make a motion 2526 to dismiss with no violation.
I'll second that, and then just add a comment that I think it was also complicated by the fact that they have had another dog with seizures that was a very different cause of the seizures and treated very differently.
Yeah.
Right? So when you have a dog with the same thing, you're like, why didn't they just do the same treatment as the other dog? When in actuality, that seizures can be so many different causes. So I think that complicated it as well. But
right.
Ultimately, I agree with you. I think with the information that they had, the vets did the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
We have a motion and a second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion passes. Okay. Section 2, number 11, case 2527, regarding Ann Goldhammer, DVM. Tracy, could you please read the front lip?
Yes, case 2527, the complainant is Neil and Renee Kegel. The respondent is Ann Goldhammer, DVM. On July 12, 2024, Nike, a 12-year-old male American Staffordshire Terrier, was presented to respond for a toe amputation of the right front claw. The dog was discharged later that day. The dog was to return every 2 days for bandage changes. On July 15, 2024, the dog returned to respond for a bandage change. On July 17, 2024, the dog was presented to respond for a bandage change. Later that day, the dog's toes became swollen, therefore the dog was presented to an emergency facility for care. The swelling was consistent with constriction. The dog's foot was treated and rebanded. Complainant was advised by the emergency veterinarian that swollen toes were a possible complication of bandage placement. Complainant presented the dog to respondent to premises twice more for bandage changes. He also expressed concerns to respondent regarding the dog's swollen toes due to bandage placement requiring an emergency visit. Complainant requested reimbursement of these. Respondent declined. And the committee concluded that no violation of the Veterinary Practice Act had occurred, and it was moved and seconded that the board dismiss this issue with no violation. The motion was approved with a vote of 3-0.
Thank you. And no respondent and no complainant present. So, Dr. James, you're the lead.
Yeah, so, I mean, this case, I think we've all seen this happen, right? The bandages can do weird things, and bandages can cause swelling. It's unfortunate that this happened when the clinic was closed, and the owner did the right thing and went to an emergency facility not knowing what else to do. But ultimately, I can't say that this was from improper placement. There's a lot of things. The dog could have been out running and moved, the bandage shifted and caused a stricture, or the bandage could have gotten wet and tightened down a little bit, and that could have caused it. So, like, there's a lot of different things that could have happened to cause it. And I think it's worth noting that this clinic was also doing these bandage changes at no charge. So they were, and I don't know if that was a result of the fact that they went to the emergency clinic and then all other bandage changes were at no charge, or if this was just kind of set out from the surgery that they were going to do these as part of the surgery and it was no charge. But there were bandage changes being done at no charge. And the reason why I bring that up is just because I feel like it's not that it changes the quality of the care provided. I think it's just that they were trying to meet with this owner and help them in any way they could. So I don't find any violations in how this case was handled. And I would make a motion in the case of 2527 that we find no violations of our Practice Act or rules.
I just wanted to zero in on this bandaging. We've had cases like this, and I've had a lot of personal experience with this type of problem. It actually, for me, goes all the way back, if you can imagine, to vet school and something I learned. doing a bandaging on something and the clinician explaining that when you're bandaging distal extremities, there are two things that are really important to do. One is padding, and two is cover the toes. And he went on to explain, and it made sense. He said, because if you don't and you get constriction at the distal end of that bandage, the problem is you've got blood in the arterial side supplying that paw. And then on the venous side, it's low pressure and it can't get out. So if you have any constriction, and therefore you get the swelling and the edema. To avoid the problems with circulation, the emphasis was cover those toes. Pad the bandage, and when I heard the audio and listened to some of the bandaging as she described it, I didn't hear anything about any padding. We use cast padding or a cotton roll or whatever. The amount can vary. You can go from a full Robert Jones down to this type of thing. So you have this problem with constriction, and you can avoid that by covering the toes. Especially if you're changing the bandage every 2 days. That's appropriate. I would have loved to have known when the owner was upset about this, decided not to go back for any bandage changes, and go back to the emergency clinic that handled it. I would have loved to have known how they handled their bandaging afterwards. I think those toes might have been covered appropriately, incorporated into the bandage. In this particular case, if we look at this case, she couldn't close the incision because this was a large area. This was not a simple dew claw removal. This was a big tumor she took off. It sounds like the surgery went very, very well. So we're dealing with an open wound on a distal extremity. This wasn't a Band-Aid type bandage. This was a full bandage. These guys, I put a Metasplit on them too, if I would have had a wound like that and covered those toes. I think you have to pay attention to circulation. I've seen this over and over again, toes swelling. And yeah, it was about 6 hours after the bandage was applied that they noticed the swelling. Could those things have happened in those 6 hours? Yeah, sure, they could have. It's possible, but it's also possible that the respondent was very fortunate that it didn't occur on the first bandage change.
Or any of the subsequent bandages.
Or any of the
that
subsequent.
Were all done the same way.
How do we know the subsequent bandage changes by the emergency doctor were done?
Well, the one by this clinician said that they were all done the same way.
This was only the second one. Second change.
She did the second one, then the client came back for the two additional ones. And when the complaint was made after all of the bandages, not just the one that had caused the issue, but after all of the bandages, she said all of them were placed the same way. I have no mm-hmm. reason why one would have caused it and not the others.
Unless we got lucky on the first one.
Or the other three, right?
Yeah.
The thing is,
follow the rule. Cover the toes.
I disagree there because we were actually not taught that, and we were actually taught that there are situations where you would want the toes exposed, one, to look for circulation issues, but also because of moist dermatitis and some other complications right. that can happen with closing the entire mm-hmm. foot. So I think that's a personal decision that you make as to what kind of bandage you're going to put on. And this ultimately healed, and I didn't see complications with the healing based on the type of bandage used. I think that there was some swelling there, and it happened for some reason, and my guess is the bandage may have been too tight. Maybe there wasn't enough padding. I don't know, but like those things happen, and I don't think we can find somebody in violation for something that is a known complication of bandages. It is a known complication that you can have swelling in the foot. So I guess for me, unless it was drastically obvious that she stretched that vet wrap and made it as tight as possible and taped it, and like I just don't know that I can say that that's a violation.
I'm not advocating it's a violation. I think it's a letter of concern.
I think it's a concern, right? Did she do the right things? I could probably go with that. I just feel like
I 100% agree with you, Dr. Nosley, because that's how I was taught, and that's definitely something that we do in the shelter environment, right? I don't want any possibility of anything coming up that way, and plus we don't have people looking at them all day, all night. But on the flip side, when yes, I was primarily taught that way, but I did have lots of externships because I was a dispersive model. I saw lots of different ways of doing it, and I had quite a few even certified doctors, board certified, that still had the toes out. So it's like there are both out there. I tend to go with the same route you do for various reasons, but. It's a method that's taught both ways, so it's kind of like it's your choice, right?
And I do tend to cover the foot on because I find that thugs have a less chance of getting it off. But that's a different reason for me going with covering the foot. But I guess I would just say I could be swayed to do a letter of concern, but I just feel like I can't make this a violation.
Well,
I think
that's appropriate. So I'm in the camp that you never leave the toes exposed. I mean, that's the way I was taught. It's the way I've done it. And I've seen so many of these cases come in because of that constriction. And yes, on the flip side, what do you have? You can't tell the circulation. Oh, I was taught that you leave a very small opening at the bottom of your bandage and have the owner put their finger in there and see if the toes are warm. Okay, that's the way we handle that. As to the moist dermatitis, you can just put your finger right between the center two toes. Is it warm?
But that's where I'm like, okay, but
then
it's a trade, but maybe not something that is a minimum standard. Just because I've never heard of it, nor have I ever done it, so.
I'll tell you.
You know what I mean?
It works pretty well.
I know. Now I might think about it, but I just don't think it's
your,
a minimum standard.
Moist dermatitis. That's the big problem, and what I really wish doctors would do, cover the toes, but pad between those toes with cotton takes care of the moist dermatitis. It does. And so that's my feeling on it, because I'm fairly adamant about that, because not only because it's the way I was taught and the way I always do it, but I've probably in my career seen 20, 30 of these. How many of them were due to the owners not following the instructions and letting the dog run around and get wet and the bandage moving? Maybe a few of them. But mostly it's just because we had a constriction.
Yeah.
And you don't know what kind of swelling you're going to have.
Well, and I don't mind that the owners were the fault. Like, the dog could have just been walking up the stairs or doing something on its own and had that bandage shift or something. I just don't know.
And how would the shifting of the bandage cause constriction?
Slipping. Slipping, but
slipping down?
If the dog then tried to chew at it and pulled it. I just think crazy things happen, and you don't always have an explanation for exactly how they happen. I think there's definitely, you obviously have different opinions of how the bandage should have been placed, but I don't feel like how this bandage was placed is definitely like a below the standard of care type thing. I've just seen it this way so many times that I can't, we would be finding 75% of the veterinarians in the state of Arizona.
I don't know.
We have
a lot of them with those open.
Yeah.
It happens a lot.
So we have a motion to dismiss with no violation. Do we have a second on that one?
I would just ask in your experience an emergency.
I think they're biologic organisms that don't cooperate with wanting to be bandaged.
No, but I meant in terms of covering the toes.
Oh, sure. Yeah, in emergency, we cover the toes. Yeah.
But how many do you see coming from private practices?
Oh, so many.
That's what I'm saying.
And I was taught in private practice for nursing skills. I was told not to cover the toes because if they start to spread, split, you know, then you know it's too tight, right? So, and then going into ER and they're like, cover the toes. I was like, oh, no. And, you know, so I was taught what you were saying. So I've been taught both ways. But again, I'm going to do what the veterinarian says. It's not my decision.
Yeah. Madam Chair, I think it's important to remember, as Dr. Jane said, that the statutes are the minimum standard. Mm-hmm. So, the question that did this fall below the minimum standard of care, I think we all agree it did not. But whether there's cause for a letter of concern, I'm not sure about that either. Okay.
So we have a motion to dismiss with no violation. Is there a second?
Second.
For that? Okay. All right. So we have a motion to dismiss with no violation. So we'll vote there. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Nay.
Okay. The ayes have it. So motion passes. All right, it is just after 10 o'clock. Do we need a bathroom break, or do we want to move forward with our next?
I'm okay.
You're good.
I'm good.
You're okay.
Thank you for asking.
Are we okay?
Yeah.
Okay. And then have we heard from?
I haven't heard, so you could go ahead and do that.
Okay. Have we checked in on them? Okay, nothing. All right. So we're going to move to section 2, number 12, case 2528, regarding Danielle Minnick, DVM, 1325, it's case 2529, Christina Lee, DVM, case 2530, Brandy Madison, DVM, case 2531, Timothy Batowski, DVM, case 2532, Anna Wilkins, DVM, case 2533, Enrico Carloon, DVM, and case 2534, Dana Caldwell, DVM. Tracy, is the summary the same on these cases?
Yes,
okay.
It is.
Could you please read the front list?
Yes. So cases 2528, 2930, 3132, 3334. The complainants are Roger and Janet Marks, and the respondents are as previously stated. On April 23rd, 2024, Marcy, an 8-year-old female Pomeranian, was transferred to the Arizona Veterinary Emergency Critical Care Center, AVEC, for continued gallbladder issues and elevated liver enzymes. Complainants expressed concerns with the care and treatment that was provided to the dog, including but not limited to administering an excessive dose of doxycycline, not diagnosing esophagitis, and placing a nasogastric tube without complainant's consent. So the committee concluded that no violation of the Veterinary Practice Act had occurred, and a motion was moved and seconded that the board dismiss these issues with no violation, and the motion was approved with a vote of 3-0.
Thank you. Council is present, monitoring?
Yes. Okay. I don't think the respondents are present.
Okay. Okay. And then the complainants are present.
Yep.
Go ahead and step forward.
Thank you.
Hello. Could you go ahead and introduce yourself?
My name is Janet Marks.
And my name is Roger Marks.
Hello. And do you have any new information to present to the board?
I have a statement.
Okay. All right. But no new information to
We both have statements. We both have permission to give them.
Okay. You can go ahead.
Thank you for this opportunity. On Tuesday, the 24th of April, Marcy's primary doctor, who was Kristen Macy, called to say that Marcy needed gallbladder surgery as soon as possible, and that if the gallbladder ruptured, Marcy would likely die. Dr. Macy said she had tried to get Marcy admitted directly to Southwest Veterinary Surgical Services, but was told that Marcy needed to come through ADEC. Our impression was this was an emergency, so we dropped everything, my husband and daughter, rushed Marcy to ADEC. They arrived with Marcy at 2 p.m. on Tuesday. We are more than concerned, we were more than concerned, when surgery was not performed until 2 days later on April 25th, from approximately 3 p.m. to 6 p.m. We were told surgery was successful and her recovery was smooth. On the following day, beginning at 2 p.m., it was a Friday, we visited with Marcy and Dr. Madison. Marcy was offered water, a variety of food. She drank some water and then she regurgitated. Dr. Madison witnessed this and it is recorded in the medical record. Marcy showed some interest in the foods offered, but Dr. Madison stated, "She's almost there," meaning that Marcy was close to being ready to eat. We told Dr. Madison that we would return that same evening between 7 and 8 p.m. with some of Marcy's favorite treats, including pepperoni. Oh, and I brought some. I don't know, I challenge anybody to find a dog that won't eat pepperoni. Dr. Madison told us that she would alert the staff that we were returning. At best, our home is a 50-minute drive one way from ADEC, but we did return that evening. We waited for some time to see Marcy, but then we were told she was undergoing a procedure. Does it sound like we had given informed consent for this procedure? My husband's 45-year career was as a hospital attorney focused on risk management and quality control. We know that no medical procedure, regardless of how commonly performed, is without risk. If we'd been told that there was a plan to insert an NG tube as soon as that evening, we would have argued to give Marcy more time to begin eating. The risks of NG insertion include irritation and damage to the esophagus, among other risks, and the esophagus and had esophagitis been recognized as a possible diagnosis, which we believe it should have been. Dr. Madison and Batkowski would have known, hopefully, that an NG tube was to be avoided, if possible. As an aside, just prior to Marcy's going into surgery, the day before, we were called by the surgeon and we gave informed consent, including consent to euthanize Marcy if a cancer was found. That was informed consent. And that's also in the record. There is mention by the investigative committee of regurgitation on extubation as being a sentinel event in this case. We don't know what this is about. We don't know if it's regurgitation at the conclusion of surgery, or is this a reference to the regurgitation witnessed by Dr. Madison earlier on Friday. Either way, it was known by Dr. Madison and Dr. Bukowski. One member of the investigative committee stated, "I wouldn't say that it was pushed under the rug, but maybe disregarded." We asked the board, is it acceptable to disregard an incident of this kind? The investigative committee appeared to have agreed that there were institutional issues at ADEC. If institutional issues contributed to some of the failures in the care and management of Marcy's case, who has the responsibility to address these issues and effect change? This is a veterinary hospital. Does not the veterinary board have a responsibility? And if not, who does? In conclusion, the investigative committee found that this was an incredibly complex case. While we agree that there are a lot of issues, there are some facts that are not disputed. Marcy was hospitalized at ABAC for 2 full days prior to surgery. That in itself should be an issue. But there was no Tylenol or regurgitation during those 2 days. Following the surgery, and for the remainder of her 8-day stay, every doctor noted Tylenol and persistent regurgitation, yet there is no indication anywhere in the record that esophagitis was even considered as a diagnosis. I believe it was one of the veterinarians on the investigative committee who stated, when there is regurgitation, the first place to look is the esophagus. Failure to do so, we submit, represents negligence at best and incompetence at worst. Dr. Madison's credentials as a diplomate qualify her as an expert in critical care, and in her role at ABAC, she would be expected to handle post-surgical cases. One of the side effects, one of the complications of a long surgical procedure is reflux into the esophagus and resulting esophagitis. Dr. Patowski holds the premises permit at ABAC and is also chief emergency veteran. We believe primary responsibility for the failures in Marcy's case began with these two doctors.
If I might, my name is Roger Marks. As my wife stated, my experience is not with TV shows. My experience is representing hospitals and doctors and nurses in both New York and Arizona for medical malpractice. I've examined and reviewed literally thousands of records. There is a difference between professional judgment and lack of professional judgment, and not exhibiting professional judgment. Marcy was seen by 10 veterinarians within a space of 7 days. My question is the same as asked by a member of the investigative committee. Who is in charge? A member of the investigative committee also asked whether the big picture was missed. I believe that is evident that the answer is yes. Each vet simply followed the thinking of their colleagues with no one asking, what are we missing? A member of the committee suggested that when there is regurgitation, the first place to look is the esophagus. Each physician noted regurgitation, tylenol, and nausea, but no one considered the esophagus and esophagitis. A number of physicians in their list of diagnoses listed regurgitation, suspect ileus, rather than considering esophagitis. Had they considered esophagitis, they would have at least considered endoscopy, which was performed 15 days post-discharge with findings of 2 large strictures. It was, unfortunately, too late to save my dog. The committee stated that this is a highly complex case. It was highly complex, then as I said at the beginning, why was nobody in charge? The record is devoid of any reference to discussions between the practitioners, whether in person, telephonically, or online. If this was a highly complex case, and Marcy was not improving, why wasn't there reaching out by any of these physicians for a consult, either with surgery or with internal medicine? A consult by an internal medicine specialist was finally conducted the day before discharge, but notes failed to mention anything about regurgitation or potential esophagitis. It should be noted by the board that when we attempted to speak to the internal medicine physician, our messages were never returned. If this is a highly complex case, why was the medical director at AFAC not at all involved? We can only go by what is in the medical record. We've heard that here. What's in the medical record is what occurred. We submit that all of these actions should have occurred, and a failure to do so is a violation of the standard of practice. The investigative committee concluded that the complaint against all of these physicians should be dismissed despite the fact that the diagnosis of esophagitis was not made and despite the fact that appropriate tests and treatments were not ordered. Instead, it appears that the committee concluded that this is an institutional issue and that basically the hands were tied. We disagree and ask the board to find either find violation or return this complaint to the committee for further consideration. Each physician failed to diagnose esophagitis or even consider it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Dr. Nosley, are you?
Yeah.
Do you have any
questions?
No. All right, you can go ahead and step back. Thank you. Okay, so Dr. Nosley, you are the lead.
Okay. The case is complex for two reasons. The underlying illness that was eventually, or cause for the illness that was eventually diagnosed and surgery performed. It's also complicated because of the number of doctors, as we've just heard. But I think the basic issue is, did all of these doctors involved miss a diagnosis of esophagitis and possible stricture? Did they all miss that and therefore would be missing a diagnosis? Not the underlying diagnosis, but a diagnosis that was a result, possible result of the illness. This idea that regurgitation or tylism is pathognomonic for esophagitis is not, that's not the case. Very ill dogs, with severe abdominal issues, and in this case, a very, very sick gallbladder, infected, had been leaking, causing adhesions. It was a 3-hour surgery, successful. These gallbladder issues usually have been going on for quite a while before they're discovered. So we have a very sick dog here. We don't know exactly when the esophagitis occurred and why it occurred. Certainly, we are all aware of the possibility of esophagitis with surgery. It's, in my experience, it's not seen very often. I've done lots of 3-hour surgeries. And to my knowledge, I can't recall a case of esophagitis and stricture. I know it does occur, but it's not like we have a 3-hour surgery, some drooling and regurgitation, so it's automatically we have to zero in on esophagitis. I think these doctors were managed this case very well in terms of this gallbladder disease with the successful surgery. So it's really hard. We don't know. There's a history of doxycycline. There was some concern that maybe it was a problem. Well, it wasn't a problem because it was given by these doctors as an injection. And so doxycycline causes esophagitis because of the presence of a pill. It caught and in cats, and some of us may have seen that. I've seen it a couple of times in cats, so that's not an issue. Giving the doxycycline and the complaints did not address that, so I think they were probably satisfied with that part. part of the investigative committee, and listening to the investigative committee, there was a lot of discussion around this, and I think some differing of opinion as to this. Would I have zeroed in on esophagitis in this patient, even if I had been the only doctor? I'm not sure. Somewhere down the road where this would the symptoms would continue, then you would, of course, and they did, and they tried to treat it, and you can often treat it, and it was treated until didn't respond and would have required more treatment. It was just awful. And I really sympathize with the owners. We had this, like I said, this terrible, terrible gallbladder disease that was successfully treated, and then we lose our dog to strictures in the esophagus. That's awful. But was that the fault of anyone in the practice? I just don't see it. Because it is not a, we have a 3-hour surgery, we're going to get esophagitis and stricture. That's just not the way it happens. It is a known complication, but it's rare. I think that's, I guess, where I would fall on this issue. And these doctors were doing everything to get this dog through this severe gallbladder disease. As to the institutional problem, this is exactly the way emergency clinics work. And listening to the investigative committee, they round their patients. Unfortunately, you can't assign a doctor to a case in an emergency situation like this. And this is the way they are handled. And I think it was handled pretty well. There was the issue of the consent about the NG tube, and there's a difference between an NG tube and a feeding tube. A feeding tube can lie in the esophagus. An NG tube goes all the way into the stomach, which this did, and that would be appropriate. Even if you have esophagitis, this could be appropriate, because now you're bypassing the esophagus when you do anything oral. So it's good therapy for that. I'm not concerned about the case management. I'm not concerned about the communication. And I really think they were successful in treating the underlying illness. It was an unfortunate complication that did occur, but not. I don't see that it's to any fault of any of the doctors, individually or collectively. And so I'm not going to make a motion until I hear from other members of the committee.
I guess for me, I agree with the majority of what you said there. I guess my question is the NG tube, not that I think that it caused more problems, because to your point, it goes directly in the stomach, but was that discussed?
Yeah.
Was, you know, permission to put the dog back under again? Like that's, you know, did we get that? Was it perhaps part of the initial estimate as a potential, and we just don't know because we don't have the estimate? And,
right.
You know, so I guess that would be a concern of mine, is that I would question if all of a sudden I found out, hey, if we put my dog back under anesthesia without giving me prior knowledge if that's what we were going to do, I would have said yes. But, you know, just on that side note.
Well, was there not some discussion that there was consent and they did have knowledge?
Wasn't it documented in the medical record?
Yeah.
There was discussion about it. But then another doctor, it looks like the other doctor placed it based on the discussion that the prior doctor had. And anytime that happens, you run the risk of miscommunication.
Sure.
And from hearing from these owners, no, I don't think they thought it was going to happen. They showed up at the clinic to see their dog. They had no idea their dog was going under another procedure. Why would they have done that? Right? I believe that they didn't know what was happening. I don't know that necessarily the doctor didn't say it in passing and not necessarily explain exactly what that meant. And so maybe the owners were like, oh, okay, yeah, yeah, yeah. And you know how you can kind of like, you're just going along with things and the doctor takes it as consent and the owners have no idea they even consented to anything, right? Like, I do think something like that could have occurred. I think that, for me, would be something I would want more clarification on, and it really is just two of the doctors, the one that placed it and the one that had noted that they had approval. I think the other doctors, yes, I think they didn't discuss esophagitis as in that term, but they were treating and monitoring the regurgitation and the clinical signs, which is really what you're looking at treating anyway, is the condition. And so I don't necessarily know that it would have changed necessarily how they would have gone about it, at least at the beginning. I think towards the end when they started to go, wait a second, then maybe it would have. And I think the doctor that ultimately diagnosed it with the endoscopy had way more information, right? You've got this whole history of what happened, and you're like, this isn't getting better, what's going on? So hindsight, and even for all of us, it's the timing, right? And so, like, even us looking back going, oh, maybe you could have seen it here, but when you're in the moment, I think it's a totally different deal to look at it at the time versus in hindsight. So I think that would have been my concern is that as well. And I just feel like, yes, this is how emergency clinics run, and in the industry we all know that emergency clinics are so, I don't even want to say they're all understaffed, but they just all have some similar issues with, there's so many pets needing treatment, and they're all running, like, with their hair on fire all the time. And we're thankful for our emergency clinics, because there are a lot of areas of the country that don't even have access to one. And so I do think that sometimes we expect things out of emergency clinics that just aren't reasonable expectations because of the nature of the work that they do. But I felt like the care here was good.
So
I think it's hard because this is not just an emergency practice. This is a specialty practice where they had boarded practitioners. So, like, yes, we have standard of care, right, in our statutes. However, kind of how I've understood it is that, yes, when you go to specialty care, that standard automatically increases too. So I think at least what I heard in the complaint, like, initially, during the conversations, right, and then the reading the complaint and then hearing today is that, yeah, they expected the level to be at specialty level, you know. So, and yes, there's a lot of doctors involved. Like, you're not going to get around that with 24/7 critical care. But there was a hole somewhere. Where was the hole at?
Yeah.
You know, and as doctors, you could probably see that a little bit better. I think that anytime you're doing an anesthetic procedure, you know, you've got to get that consent, you know. And so is it an in-passing conversation, and did that get documented clearly? I didn't really see that, so maybe that's what I'm missing, and maybe you all saw it in there. But I think that was kind of the initial shock, and then things kind of, again, the way I'm hearing it, and I could be wrong, it kind of spiraled out of control of trust and understanding between, you know, these responsible pet owners and this team that was very well qualified to care for, you know, this patient. So,
yes, it was a special practice, but, you know, we have to decide the minimum standard of care is met.
But I'm just saying the expectation.
The expectation
rises.
By the owner.
Yes.
By the client.
Absolutely.
Oh, absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely. But for us, statute-wise, it's minimum standard of care.
Yeah. There's always a level of disconnect there, right?
Yeah.
As a pet owner, I expect a level of care that's different than the minimum standard.
Exactly.
So I wouldn't go to a doctor that I thought was providing the minimum standard of care.
Right.
I would go to a doctor that I felt like was providing above that minimum standard. And that's what people want.
Yes. Yeah.
But what we are doing is the minimum standard of care. So I do think that's always a disconnect.
It's always
a problem. That is going to be an issue.
Yeah, it's always a problem. And for us as a board to try to address this as the term an institutional problem, when we've had similar type problems and we've looked to the responsible veterinarian, then we look at what was their improper training, or not not supervision of a case. That's not what the responsible veterinarian does. So I don't think this is one of those cases where we can go, well, we need to hear from the responsible veterinarian because this case went bad. That's not what they do.
No.
So I don't see that. So my only issue is the issue that you both brought up about the tube placement, the consent for that, and it being another anesthetic procedure. So is that enough that we need to move this to an informal? And if we do, we can't separate out doctors and do it for one and not for the other. Because as we've had in the past, we have to hear from them all.
Yeah.
Because they're all involved in the case, regardless of how minimum. I would love that we could, but there's been cases in the past where no, we need to hear from everybody. So do we move this to informal because of this one issue?
But could we? I mean, you're looking at two doctors that saw this patient before surgery even happened, and the NG tube wasn't even in question.
Right.
I don't think they would have had any relation to approval for an NG tube, right? So do we think anything happened while they were on duty? No, because even the esophagitis, I mean, the one consulted with one of the criticalists, so you know, to that point of it's an emergency clinic and a referral hospital, they did consult. So I mean, I feel like you can easily say those two weren't involved.
Sure.
I think the question is where it is in the medical record is with case 30, and who placed it is with case 31. So do you hold making a decision on those and get more information, or move them to an informal to get more information?
Right, because we didn't have
along?
We didn't have the estimates. Is that the thing?
I didn't see any estimates.
I missed it.
There's a lot of records.
And I didn't see an estimate, but I just feel like we would need more information as to how was that communicated. What did you describe was going to be? How did you describe what an NG tube was, and how did you describe how it's placed, and when did this happen? Yeah, so I think that would be. But that would be, to me, it would be case 30 and 31, and the others.
I agree.
To that
so
issue.
Historically, have we ever done that? Because cases that I've had,
we have.
We have done that historically.
I think the ones where we don't are the ones where we're concerned about a medical issue where it might linger back to one of the other doctors, whereas this is more of a approval or medical.
During the course.
I mean,
that makes sense.
Victoria, would you feel comfortable with that approach as far as if we're really concerned about the approved consent, just limiting it to those two doctors and moving the others on?
I think we could do that. Okay, great.
Thank you. That helps. That helps tremendously. So I'll make a case. I'll make a motion. Let me get these numbers right here. Let's just start with one case 30 and 31. I will make a motion to move those two to informal.
Second.
I
have a motion and a second. All is in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
And then the
opposed?
Oh, sorry.
Motion passes? Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. So let's look at the other numbers here. Where we at? Okay. Yeah, let's do it that way. In the case of 2528, I would make a motion to dismiss with no violation.
Second.
Do you have a motion and a second? All those in favor?
Aye.
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 And then in case 2529, I would make a motion to dismiss with no violation.
Second.
Do you have a motion and a second? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion passes.
And then in case 2532, I will make a motion to dismiss with no violation.
Second.
Motion and second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes.
And in case 2533, I'll make a motion to dismiss with no violation.
Second.
Your motion is second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion passes.
And 234. 2534, I'll make a motion to dismiss with no violation.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion passes. Okay. Thank you. Are you good to keep moving forward? Okay. All right, we'll take 5 minutes, so 10:40.
Thank you.
Thank you.